You're listening to The Mastic Diplomat. Welcome back, everyone, to episode 9 of Understanding Europe. Today, we will discuss the legitimacy of the EU as an external democracy promoter or exporter in its southern and eastern neighborhood, while internally it is dealing with a rule of law crisis in member states such as Poland, Hungary, and Austria. So we're going to ask questions like, has this internal crisis affected the way the EU is perceived? Has it hindered its legitimacy as an international player? Basically asking how people in these neighborhoods view the EU. And to answer these questions, we are joined by Asim Dandashli, an assistant professor at the Department of Political Science at FASOS, Gergana Nocheva, an associate professor in international relations and European foreign policy at the Political Science Department, also at FASOS. Together with Olga Burluk, they have co-authored a recently published article in the Journal of European Public Policy titled External Democracy Promotion in Times of Internal Rule of Law Crisis, the EU and its Neighborhood. With them, we will discuss their research and their findings to learn more about the topic of EU external democracy promotion and how it is viewed in the neighborhood in which it is promoting democracy, so to say. So let's get the conversation started.
Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your research focuses on the question of legitimacy of the EU as an actor in democracy promotion and human rights promotion. In the face of its own domestic rule of law crisis, and how that relates to its external action. Could you elaborate maybe on the context of your research, giving us some key concepts to understand why you focused on this and where it comes from?
I think what we were trying to do is we study EU democracy promotion beyond its borders, and we focus on the neighboring countries towards the east and the south. And what we were trying to do, okay, if the EU is viewed as one of the key players in promoting democracy internationally, to what extent having problems of democracy internally affect that? And when we look at the rule of law crisis, democratic backsliding, we see that some countries such as Hungary and Poland are suffering from such a problem. And the thing that we try to do is, okay, to what extent does this internal democratic problem or legitimacy of the EU as an actor in terms of democracy, to what extent this problem affects the EU ability to promote democracy beyond its borders towards its eastern neighbors and the southern neighbors, where it seeks to promote rule of law, human rights, democracy, etc. So that was the idea behind the research. And of course, we will elaborate further on each region.
When we say eastern and southern neighborhood, what do we mean by that exactly?
Well, the eastern neighborhood are the immediate neighbors of the EU on its eastern border. But here, of course, we don't mean the Western Balkans, because the Western Balkans are immediate neighbors as well, but they are potential candidates for membership. And so they are treated in a different policy framework by the EU. By the way, some of the eastern neighbors are also accession candidates at the moment, as of last year. So the political geography of the EU when it comes to the eastern neighborhood is changing a little bit. But here we wanted to develop this article in the context of the European neighborhood policy, which is developed for the eastern and the southern neighbors. And Asim can talk more about the southern neighbors.
Yeah, for the southern neighbors, it's all the countries that are part of the European neighborhood policy, from Morocco in the west to Jordan, Lebanon, Syria in the east, plus Egypt, Libya, Tunisia. So all these countries that are part of the European neighborhood policy on the Mediterranean. So we don't look at countries beyond that that region, because the relations between the EU and those countries are slightly different. While with the neighboring countries, they are governed by the European neighborhood policy. And one of the key aspects of that policy is to promote well-governed states that are functioning democracies, or like that are democracies and respect the rule of law, human rights, minority rights, etc.
And I think that also brings us to another kind of definition question. So the rule of law crisis internally in the EU, in a couple of words, what does that actually mean?
It is perceived as a crisis within the EU, and that's one of the main points of our research. But we wanted to look at whether the crisis is perceived externally as a crisis as well. If we talk about rule of law crisis, this is to say that some of the countries in the EU, not only in Eastern member states, but also the Western member states as well, they are experiencing rule of law, what we call rule of law backsliding. That means that, you know, there are certain checks and balances that are being degraded internally via the political establishment. And progressively, there is a concern that these countries are going backwards on democracy, on democratic, on key democratic criteria.
Yeah, so what we see in Poland or Hungary mostly is the issues related to the judiciary, related to the independence of the central bank, related also to the minority communities in that in those countries. So we see a lot of backsliding when it comes to these issues, especially when it comes to the liberal values that the EU adheres to. But also I would reiterate the point that Gergana mentioned is we do also notice that the literature and the empirics show that there is democratic backsliding, not only in the East, but also in the Western European countries. But the literature focuses mostly on the East. But this is also a phenomenon that we see it not only in the East and in the West, but also internationally in the decline of the liberal democracies in the world over the past couple of years.
And so if I get this right, what you kind of focused on is while within the EU, the perception of this backsliding is really one of crisis, of issue, big issue. And what instead you also wanted to look at is how that is then seen in the southern neighborhood, in the eastern neighborhood, almost from like an outsider's looking in or in general. What's the difference between the two? Like, how important is it in general for average people, or what's the...
We do take a societal perspective, but we can come back to it as well later. But what is interesting for us from an academic point of view is this whole debate about decentering. And what we mean by it is, you know, our approach has been too Eurocentric, focusing too much on what's going on internally within the EU and trying to see and understand everything through such an internal gaze. Whereas what we are trying to do is to shift the lens and to say, well, what if we interrogate the societies themselves and ask them whether they see a change and whether they would follow the EU's democracy promotion guidelines less because of this internal rule of law crisis? And we actually find the opposite, that they are not so much concerned about what's going on internally because they look at it through a local lens. And we can come back to it as well. But the big interest for us academically is this whole move in social sciences, in European studies, European foreign policy to decenter the scholarship and to try and move beyond an internal EU focus.
So you say you take a societal view, then how did you go about collecting your data? And what societal partners did you talk to?
So before going into the societal aspect, I think what we aim to do is to look at what the societies, local agencies, local societies want. We always look at what the EU wants and how the EU have its sets of conditions and sets of policies that it want to implement in those countries, without taking into consideration what the societies really care about or what are their priorities, how they view the European Union, and what do they want from the European Union. It is something that we always ignore. And this is where the criticism to the Eurocentric approach by the EU and all the calls for decentering and decolonizing, and the views of the EU in the local societies. The EU is considered to be a neo-colonial player with different policies and different ways of performing its approach. So all these things have been taken into consideration when we look at the local context. And I think giving the local context an important voice and hearing, listening to what those people want is very important. Because again, another issue that we see is the role of the elites. Most of the time you interview elites in the south or in the east, and then you interview elites in Brussels or member states, and then you collect the data this way and you give more voice to what the people in the leading positions want. And I think what is missing in all this context is what the elites want is different than what the societies want, especially that we are talking about countries that, especially when we are talking about the South, countries that do not have the same democratic principles and changes every 4 years or free and fair elections, or they're a real functioning democracies. So that's where the societal aspects come in. And then we looked at a lot of the, especially in the South, and I think Gergana will elaborate more on the East. In the South, we looked at these surveys that have been conducted over the past years. And that's the Arab Barometer data, World Bank indicators, also some projects that really measured the societal positions. So those, what do people, when you say the EU, what does the EU mean for those people? When you talk about crisis, what does crisis mean? When you talk about democracy, what is democracy? Because we always come with the Eurocentric position that democracy is liberal democracy, but that's not the same way people in the South or in the East or in other parts of the world conceive democracy.
Well, largely we looked at surveys, opinion polls, representative opinion polls. Some of them were repeated over the years, so we could have a bit of a longer time series to be sure of whether there are any changes over time or not, and what these changes are, if they exist. And we complemented that with country-specific representative surveys on questions that were interesting for us and for our research, mostly, as Asim was saying, around the questions of what democracy is and how the EU is seen from the society perspective. And we make very clear that, you know, this may be different from the elite views in these countries. And we stay away of the elite views, right? That would have actually entailed a very different research methodology to study the elite views. But we just focused on the societal in order to be able to tap into local values, local norms, local attitudes and perceptions, right? And see whether they differ from what the EU is trying to sort of export promote in these places. But that's the motivation to go into the societal, right? To be able to say something about local values, local meanings, local collective attitudes. And that's important, and that's missing from the debate, because the debate is too much elite focus, and we wanted to move away from this, because this is true decentering in a way.
Also on the societal aspect, in a lot of the discussions we have, you see that the EU, elites meet with the elites in the neighboring countries. Even the civil society organizations haven't been involved that much in all the debate, in all the discussions, in the meetings that have taken place over the past decades. We see more attempt by CSO, civil society organizations, to be more involved in some countries. They have been successful to a certain extent, but the broader societal positions, the people's position, is always ignored, not only by the local political elites, but also by the European Union, because again, it comes with a package, and they want to implement it regardless of what the societies want, and regardless of what is really a priority for those people. Like you talk about democracy, human rights, when people cannot find, for example, work to do or do not have like enough money to make a living. So the priorities also are different. And this is what we try to look at, is this is why the societal lens is very important. And looking at the local public is important in the relations between the EU and those countries, especially if we want to look at, if we want to have an effective EU policy toward those countries.
And actually on that, so that if there is a disconnect, that disconnect, how would it affect the how the EU is viewed as an actor, or its legitimacy in general in promoting a democracy?
I mean, the societal views we link directly to EU legitimacy. And that's the other contribution or originality of our article, if you will, because all of the models that talk about EU legitimacy, they look at internal EU characteristics. Right, they look at the way in which decisions are arrived at in the EU, the way in which this is produced internally. But we shift the lens and say, well, actually, legitimacy is in the eyes of the beholder. And so if the EU is, if these societies view the EU as a credible actor, then you know, that's what legitimate is in a transnational context, right? And that's the difference, and that's the link also to the decentering approach, because legitimate for us is what these societies say is legitimate for them. It's not what it is legitimate for the EU itself.
So the perceptions of the local societies of the EU and legitimacy is derived from their perceptions, like to what extent those societies view the EU as a legitimate actor when it comes to, for example, democracy promotion or other areas. And that's where the local lens is very important, because you can, internationally, the EU can be considered legitimate by the political elite. It can be considered legitimate, but to what extent the societies consider this player, the EU, as a legitimate actor, solo and also in comparison to other international actors when it comes to this specific policy area.
So, I mean, now that we have an understanding of your research in terms of the broader concepts and how you went about getting there, could you run us through maybe some of your findings then, maybe starting with how the EU is viewed then in terms of both in the southern neighborhood and the eastern neighborhood, but then also some specific aspects of it. I'm sure you can guide us through.
Overall, where the EU was legitimate, continues to be legitimate. Where it wasn't legitimate, it continues to be illegitimate in specific areas. So the rule of law crisis internally, and here like we'll zoom in on the south, didn't really affect the image of the EU. But the EU is not viewed by those communities to be the beacon of democracy promotion. It is viewed more from the angle of economy, some human rights issues, as a promoter of human rights, equality. So from these areas, but as a democracy promoter, it's not really viewed as the beacon of democracy. This is one. And the second thing is the EU is not... when it comes to the EU, people, the EU rule of law crisis in the in its eastern, in some of the eastern neighbors, two things come up. What is crisis? Because you're talking about rule of law crisis and you're making a huge fuss out of it in the EU about like some liberal values being violated or some cracking down or on the independency of the judiciary, etc., when people definition of crisis is so different in many countries in the south. Crisis means not being able to go to schools. Crisis means not being able to have a job. Crisis means like all the wars and conflicts and the mess that the MENA region is facing. So the crisis for them is way more than just like some legal document, some laws are being violated here or there. So also the concept of crisis is so different. And the third point is, as I said, like the third point is also the, despite all this, as I said, the EU is not viewed mostly for democracy, but it is viewed more positively than other actors. So when we put the EU in comparative perspective to, let us say, the United States or Russia or China or others, we see that the EU is viewed more positively by the societies compared to the other players.
And this is generally how it's viewed, or as a as a democracy promoter, as a beacon of democracy in quotation marks?
In both sense, because like again, the EU is viewed for other areas, as I said, like human rights, trade, economy, etc. But compared to the US and to the United States, for example, or Russia or other countries, they are not viewed as positively as the EU, but also not viewed as the main promoters of democracy when it comes in comparative terms with the European Union. So we see this, but also on overall, we see that the EU is viewed by these surveys, by the people who participated, is viewed more positively compared to the other players, generally speaking. And when it comes to democracy, it is among the very few players that is viewed to promote democracy compared, for example, to Russia or Turkey or the Gulf countries, which are more like interest-oriented and more about security, economy, rather than democratic values.
Perhaps an important difference with the Eastern neighborhood, between the Southern and the Eastern neighborhood, in the East, the EU is recognized for its political values by societies, and those are considered legitimate values, also in the local context. And so here the EU has space to promote a political agenda. Well, again, there's a difference, right? In the Eastern neighborhood, we have some countries that are a bit more receptive to the political norms that come from the EU, and others less so. So Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia in particular are the ones that in the surveys show a higher association of human rights and rule of law issues with the EU and its promotion of those values. So it's important also to know that these are not blocks, right? Homogeneous blocks. There's quite a bit of differentiation within these neighborhoods. And in the Eastern one, the EU political message has been very receptive by some societies. Not surprisingly, the ones that are now also candidates for EU accession. So that's an important difference. So there, it's an important policy agenda, if you will, for the EU, that there's space to help out these societies achieve goals that are considered legitimate goals from the local perspective. And in that sense, we are talking about, you know, EU being a legitimate democracy promoter, right? Because it is not imposing an agenda that is foreign to the local context and to the local norms and views.
Now, one thing on the South, what is contested and viewed very negatively by the local societies is this focus on liberal aspects of democracy. And this is something that is highly contested in the Middle East and North Africa, especially when it comes to the promotion of minority rights, LGBTIQ, or even the understanding of gender equality and the gender roles in the society. And this is where the EU is heavily criticized for, like, pushing the Western-oriented understanding of these values to societies that are different in terms of culture, religion, history. And this is where also, if we look at the more recent surveys, we see criticisms to the EU and the international community when it comes to trying to push these values or impose these values on the societies of those countries.
I wanted to ask if the perception of how the Eastern and the Southern neighborhood framed what the EU is had any effect on their perception of its legitimacy as a democracy promoter. So if the framing of the EU as an institution, did it have any effect on how the Eastern and Southern neighborhood saw the legitimacy of the EU, or were more receptive of EU values or political agendas or economic values?
Well, our research shows that, historical legacies matter here. And this article is actually part of a larger special issue that looks at the East-West divide internally within the EU. And our contribution actually addresses the question of whether this East-West divide is also manifests itself externally. And what comes out of the surveys is that very often the societies in the neighborhood think of the EU as the core EU, as the old member states, the Western European member states. The Eastern European member states do not kind of take part in the political imagination of these societies. So from the point of view of the neighborhood societies, the EU is the Western European, are the Western European member states. And so that is why, in a way, this East-West divide doesn't play such a big role in the international politics of the EU, because the external perception is that it's still the old member states that act on behalf of the EU.
And is that perception the same in Eastern and Southern neighborhood, or is there a difference in the way the EU is viewed?
I think in the Eastern neighborhood, there's a step in overcoming that, because the Eastern member states are very close politically with the Eastern neighbors and have shared a common past not so long ago. So at least there is the knowledge and understanding that these societies are a little bit like us. Whereas in the Southern neighborhood, this is very dramatic, because Eastern Europe doesn't appear on the political map of these societies, it seems.
Yeah, for the MENA region, when we look at the EU, or when you ask people what is the EU, in most of the people's imagination, it's Western Europe. And to be more precise, when you ask, so what Western Europe is, it's France, it's Italy, Spain, the UK even. This is many people who are not aware of the Brexit, etc. This is for them Europe. So when it comes to the East Europeans, when you talk, yeah, but like the EU can include also many countries from Eastern Europe, such as Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, etc. For them, this doesn't click. And for them, these are countries that are not as advanced as the other Western European countries. So it's still in the imagination of many people. And of course, you can see differences in the based on the age of the participants in the surveys. But overall, the connection is always to the Western European countries. And like colonization period does play a role in that. And many people, many countries that were under the French colonies or the Spanish or the Italian, or do connect with the former colonies. And the dream for them is to end up in one of these former colonies, for example, to study or have like internships or to work. So what's happening in the East doesn't really concern them and doesn't affect the, in a way, this internal East-West divide doesn't appear in the political imagination of the societies. And also, it doesn't seem to affect the position of the EU and the image of the EU and the legitimacy of the EU in those societies.
There is probably here an important difference between the Southern and the Eastern neighborhood, because in the Eastern neighborhood, there is no such colonial baggage, if you will. And so the EU is seen more purely, if you will, from the point of view of these societies, because in the Eastern European context, the imperial power, the colonial power is Russia. And so in this sense, this whole move towards Europe, move towards democracy, is to some extent a decolonialization agenda for these societies. And that's why it appears so legitimate from their point of view, because they are running away from a different colonial power, if you will. I mean, it's a different question whether the EU can establish a different hierarchy here through this process, because it is the more powerful actor here, and whether in this democratization agenda there is a recolonization agenda as well. But certainly when it comes to the legitimacy dynamics in these two neighborhoods, the colonial past plays a big difference in understanding local perceptions.
Also, maybe if Gergana can correct me also, the Eastern members are sort of role models for the further East or the neighboring countries, because they made it to the EU. So in a way, they are countries to emulate or to follow the footstep in order to become part of the European Union. And this is something that is different in the East compared to the South, as Gergana highlighted.
So going back to your findings, that's why political views of the EU have more legitimacy in the eastern neighborhood rather than the southern neighborhood. So there is an effect of the colonial baggage in the way the EU is perceived. Is that, did I get it right?
Well, this is not coming directly from the article, right? Because we don't have such surveys that ask about the colonial past. But, you know, this is an extension of, our research, because we've seen it through other pieces of research of ours, right? That this comes back, right? And now in the Eastern neighborhood, especially so in the context of Russia's war against Ukraine, this has become so obvious for everyone, not only people working in academia and delving with these issues on the academic side of it.
Yeah, beyond the article, what we see that affects the legitimacy of the EU is other things than the rule of law crisis, especially in the MENA. And here we, especially when we look at democracy promotion and the prioritization of security, fighting illegal migration, fighting terrorism, collaborating with dictatorships of the regions, this is what affects the image of the EU as a democracy promoter. Because when you talk to people in the region, what they ask you, like, yeah, but the EU is supporting these dictators for a long time. We had good relations with Mubarak for his entire presidencies. We had like collaboration with Gaddafi in Libya. We had good relations with Ben Ali until even when the protests started, the French were offering support to Ben Ali's regime, despite what the people wanted. And this was heavily criticized by the Tunisian societies. Also in some interviews, this was reflected. So what the EU is doing, saying something and then prioritizing security at the expense of the well-being, the democratic well-being of societies, this does affect the image of the EU. And what happened, the treatment of the refugees, the differences between 2015 versus the Ukrainian refugees, this affected the EU negatively, the image of the EU, and sort of the beacon of democracy, human rights, respect of human rights, etc. This is something that affects the image of the EU negatively, more than the internal rule of law crisis in some of its member states.
So the kind of securitization of the southern neighborhood, while there is a kind of an open access policy for Ukrainian refugees, that was a big in effect on how people were viewed the EU as a legitimate actor in the southern neighborhood.
True, absolutely. Okay. And this was reflected in empirical data, like past our article. But a refugee is a refugee. But when you hear like some political leaders in the EU and in some member states making some comments that are not politically right regarding real refugees versus non-real refugees, these are like us versus the others who are coming from African countries or other countries, this doesn't really sound right. And it's not accepted. Because if you're trying to move or escaping for your life, regardless where you're coming from, it's a human life that you want to save. regardless of your race, ethnicity, religion, background, this shouldn't even be considered an issue. So this was taken very negatively in the MENA region, especially that, you know, with the social media, with the news and the media focusing a lot on what the political elites are saying in the EU regarding this issue, this becomes even more problematic. And also some of the recent comments about the jungle and the... all this is basically... Now with the social media, everything that you say as a politician spreads
like fire.
Like fire.
But did these rhetorics have a positive impact then in the Eastern neighborhood?
I mean, most of the Eastern European member states were the ones that accepted the Ukrainian refugees. And so they were very supportive. I mean, Poland, Slovakia, you know, Romania, they were on the front line. So while Eastern Europe has been very reticent to accept refugees from the MENA region, there has been no question about accepting refugees from Ukraine. And clearly here, identity plays a role. Populism plays a role as well. I mean, many of the populist parties in Eastern Europe have been branding refugees from MENA as a security threat and linking it to their Muslim identity. So that rhetoric was very strong and explains why Eastern Europe didn't accept at all and was not sympathetic at all to the plight of all of these refugees running from the Syrian conflict. But then they did the opposite with the Ukrainian refugees, because here the identity card plays a big role. They are like us, and everyone in a way associated with their plight. And it was very, very easy at societal level. And the kind of solidarity we witnessed, it's incomparable between the two refugee inflows.
But that contrast between refugees coming from the MENA region and refugees coming from Ukraine, fleeing from Ukraine, in the MENA, it had a negative impact on the image of the EU as an international player. How did that play out in the Eastern neighborhood?
That I am not entirely sure, but I can only speculate. I haven't seen any surveys on that, but I can only speculate that this was seen positively.
I think this kind of comes back to the overall kind of theme of, or not theme, but the paradigm of the research. Looking at a decentered approach, a non-Eurocentric academic view of looking at how these societies themselves think of their needs, the EU as an actor and other actors involved in their region. Do you have any last important things you want to impart of how this specific approach not only affected your research, but can maybe lead to a full qualitative understanding of this topic and others, perhaps?
I think the key is for any foreign policy that the EU want to implement beyond its borders, especially in the neighboring countries, it has to take the local context seriously. You cannot keep collaborating with dictators or with the elites, ignoring what the societies want. And you cannot go with this prescribed understanding or with this one-size-fit-all thing and try to implement it everywhere. And you cannot go with your liberal democracy and say this is the only way of having a democratic system. There are different understandings of democracies, and there are different types of democracies, and the liberal democracy is only one type. And if it doesn't fit in a society or in certain region, you cannot enforce it. And the last thing is, you cannot say something and then do the opposite. Like you preach about democracy, human rights, freedoms, and then like you collaborate with elites who do exactly the opposite. Just because you want to secure your borders, you want to collaborate with these dictators to protect your borders, you externalize your borders to those countries because they can do the dirty work that we cannot do on EU soils. As long as you have this hypocritical approach and saying something and then doing something and then prioritizing or securitization of the relations with the neighboring countries, especially in the south, the EU image will keep deteriorating in those countries. And this is something that EU politicians and also policymakers have to take it more seriously if you want to be effective, if you want to be a legitimate player beyond its borders, especially in the neighboring countries.
But on the more positive side, perhaps, you know, this could also go the other way, right? Because many times the EU is shooting itself in the foot, so to say, trying to think that it cannot do anything meaningful in a context, whereas in the Eastern neighborhood it can, and some of the societies in these countries actually want the EU to do more. Obviously, the EU cannot do more in its own fashion; it has to respect the local context. So the key takeaway indeed is local agency. You can't do these policies in Brussels through your own biases. You have to go out in the field, talk to the people, take into account what they want, and design a policy in partnership with them, so that, you know, you have a chance to be an effective player. Because if you just go with a prescribed policy from Brussels, chances are that, you know, this will not go well on the ground. But if you actually change the lens and try to do this in partnership with these societies, you can be effective and legitimate at the same time.
And I think this is where the EU delegations can play a lot of important role, by collaborating and engaging with the societies and the civil society organizations in those countries. Because they are on the ground, they are in the targeted countries, and they are in direct contact with the locals. And I think this is one of the things that we can start from there, and empower, giving more to the delegations in terms of information, in terms of access to resources, in terms of engaging with the societies, and then conveying this message to the bureaucracies in Brussels, and trying to include, to be more inclusive to the local demands when it comes to implementing certain policies in those countries without affecting the values and the norms that we stand by in the European Union.
Thank you very much. I think it's a good point to kind of move on to our last segment of the podcast. It's our secondary sources segment. So we ask you to bring us another source for people who are interested in engaging more with this topic. So would either of you like to share what you've brought to share with our listeners?
Well, on the decentering agenda, I think we want to single out the work by Stephen Cochlear and Sharon Lecoq. Yes, they have been driving this research line, but also Calypso Nicolaidis and Nora Fisher-Honor. So they are the ones with the first plea to decenter EU foreign policy in particular. And so our work is specifically on democracy promotion, but, you know, this is a bigger research agenda and there's space for a lot more research here.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Links will obviously be in the description. Thank you again to both of you for coming and talking to us.
Thank you for having
us
today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone at home, for listening, or wherever you are. And see you again soon.
The music for the MD podcast episode has been produced by Stone Ocean. And this podcast episode has been produced, recorded, and edited by Brendan Hogan and yours truly, Sheryl Abdullah. Talk to you soon.